I'll see you here at recess. Much of student behavior is opportunistic and undertaken in reaction to the gray area, I can get away with it, so I will. A far smaller number of students will persist in a behavior once you've made it unambiguous what you expect. Fewer still will do so when you've shown you're persistent. This is discussed further in What to Do. Even more effective might be a firmer iteration of no opt-out before returning to James. Tell him again, David, what's the subject? And then, let's try it again, James. What's the subject of the sentence? Or you could repeat the answer yourself. James, the subject of this sentence is mother. Now you tell me, what's the subject? Regardless of which approach you take, the sequence ends with the original student repeating the correct answer. The subject is mother. In the case of Charlie, if Devin didn't answer and tried to mimic Charlie's impassivity, you might give the answer yourself. Class, 3 times 8 is 24. Devin, what is it? Good. Now you, Charlie. In a minute, we'll look at some of the more academically rigorous variations on no opt-out. But first, I want to underscore how the technique allows you to ensure that all students take responsibility for learning. It establishes a tone of student accountability, and it honors and validates students who do know the answer by allowing them to help their peers in a positive and public way. I also want to underscore that the worst-case examples I've given above are fairly anomalous. The tone of no opt-out in most classrooms is astoundingly positive and academic. Using it empowers you to cause all students to take the first step, no matter how small. It reminds them that you believe in their ability to answer. And it results in students hearing themselves succeed and get answers right. This causes them to grow increasingly familiar with successful outcome. No opt-out normalizes this process with the students who need it most. No opt-out. Clip 1. In clip 1 on the DVD, Daryl Williams of Brighter Choice Charter School for Boys in Albany, New York, demonstrates no opt-out twice. In the first instance, he calls on a student to read the word acted. When he isn't successful, Williams sticks with the boy, providing a cue himself until the student includes the suffix. As Williams notes, the objective for the day's lesson is to read and understand suffixes, so it's probably worth taking the time to cue the student as he does. In the second instance, when the student is unable to read the word performance, Williams calls on another student and then returns to the original student. Read it, Jamel. In this case, it's not probably worth the time to break down the error, as the decoding skill the student struggles with is less closely related to the day's objective. That said, Williams has still firmly established a strong accountability loop. There are 4 basic formats of no opt-out. I've provided examples below, with each presented as a variation of the James sequence in Williams' classroom. What's consistent across all 4 cases is that a sequence that begins with the student unable to answer ends with the student giving the right answer. This ensures that everyone comes along on the march to college. Format 1. You provide the answer. The student repeats the answer. Teacher. What's the subject, James? James. Happy. Teacher. James, the subject is mother. Now you tell me, what's the subject? James. The subject is mother. Teacher. Good, James. The subject is mother. Format 2. Another student provides the answer. The initial student repeats the answer. Teacher. What's the subject, James? James. Happy. Teacher. Who can tell James what the subject of the sentence is? Student 2. Mother. Teacher. Good. Now you, James. What's the subject? James. The subject is mother. Teacher. Yes, the subject is mother. A variation on this method is to ask the whole class, rather than one individual student, to provide the correct answer, using call and response, technique 23 in chapter 4, and then have the initial student repeat. Teacher, what's the subject, James? James, happy. Teacher, on the count of 2, class, tell me what the subject of the sentence is. 1, 2, class, mother. Teacher, what is it? Class, mother. Teacher, James, what's the subject? James, mother. Teacher, good, James. Format 3. You provide a cue. Your student uses it to find the answer. Teacher, what's the subject, James? Student 1. Happy. Teacher, James, when I ask you for the subject, I am asking for who or what the sentence is about. Now, James, see if that can help you find the subject. James, mother. Teacher, good, James. The subject is mother. Format 4. Another student provides a cue. The initial student uses it to find the answer. Teacher, what's the subject, James? James, happy. Teacher, who can tell James what I am asking for when I ask for the subject? Student 2. You're asking for who or what the sentence is about. Teacher, yes, I am asking for who or what the sentence is about. James, what's the subject? James, mother. Teacher, good, James. The subject is mother. I use the word cue here to mean a hint that offers additional useful information to the student in a way that pushes him or her to follow the correct thinking process. A hint, by contrast, could offer any information. If I ask, can anyone give James a hint to help him find the subject? A student might say, it starts with the letter M. This would surely help James guess the answer, but doesn't teach him anything that will help him next time. When you ask your students to provide a cue, be sure to provide guidance as to what kind of cue would be useful. 3 cues are particularly useful. The place where the answer can be found. Who can tell James where he could find the answer? The step in the process that's required at the moment. Who can tell James what the first thing he should do is? Another name for the term that's a problem. Who can tell James what denominator means? So, how should you go about deciding which type of no opt-out to use? As a rule of thumb, sequences in which students use cues to answer questions are more rigorous than those in which students merely repeat answers given by others. And sequences in which students do more of the narration and intellectual work are generally preferable. At the same time, there's no way to slow down enough to cue every student in the most rigorous way toward the answer to every question that stumps somebody. You'd never get anything else done. And if you do, you risk not only losing your momentum, but you allow students to co-opt the lesson by constantly feigning ignorance and cleverly taking you off task. In seeking to balance between providing cues, slow but rigorous, and providing answers, fast but more superficial, you'll probably find it helpful to go back to your objective. The closer the question you asked is to your lesson objective, the worthier of a slower and more cognitively rigorous no opt-out it probably is. If it's a peripheral topic, speed through it by taking the right answer quickly from a peer, asking for a repeat of it by the original student, and moving on. No matter what balance you strike, students in your classroom should come to expect that when they say they can't answer, or when they answer incorrectly, there is a strong likelihood that they will conclude their interaction by demonstrating their responsibility and ability to identify the right answer. Technique 2. Right is right. Right is right is about the difference between partially right and all the way right, between pretty good and 100%. The job of the teacher is to set a high standard for correctness, 100%. The likelihood is strong that students will stop striving when they hear the word right, or yes, or some other proxy. So there's a real risk to naming as right that which is not truly and completely right. When you sign off and tell a student she is right, she must not be betrayed into thinking she can do something that she cannot. Many teachers respond to almost correct answers their students give in class by rounding up. That is, they'll affirm the student's answer and repeat it, adding some detail of their own to make it fully correct, even though the student didn't provide and may not recognize the differentiating factor. Imagine a student who's asked at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet how the Capulets and Montagues get along. They don't like each other, the student might say, in an answer that most teachers would, I hope, want some elaboration on before they called it fully correct. Right, the teacher might reply. They don't like each other, and they have been feuding for generations. But of course the student hadn't included the additional detail. That's the rounding up. Sometimes the teacher will even give the student credit for the rounding up as if the student said what he did not, and what she merely wished he'd said. As in, right, what Kylie said was that they don't like each other and have been feuding. Good work, Kylie. Either way, the teacher has set a low standard for correctness, and explicitly told the class that they can be right even when they are not. Just as important, she has crowded out students' own thinking, doing cognitive work that students could do themselves. For example, So is this a recent thing? A temporary thing? Who can build on Kylie's answer? When answers are almost correct, it's important to tell students that they're almost there, that you like what they've done so far, that they're closing in on the right answer, that they've done some good work or made a great start. You can repeat a student's answer back to him so he can listen for what's missing and further correct. For example, you said the Capulets and Montagues didn't get along. Or you can wait or prod or encourage or cajole in other ways to tell students what still needs doing. Ask who can help to get the class all the way there until you get students all the way to a version of right that's rigorous enough to be college prep. Kylie, you said the Capulets and the Montagues didn't get along. Does that really capture their relationship? Does that sound like what they'd say about each other? In holding out for right, you set the expectation that the questions you ask and their answers truly matter. You show that you believe your students are capable of getting answers as right as students anywhere else. You show the difference between the facile and the scholarly. This faith in the quality of a right answer sends a powerful message to your students that will guide them long after they have left your classroom. Over the years, I've witnessed teachers struggle to defend right answers. In one visit to a fifth-grade classroom, a teacher asked her students to define peninsula. One student raised his hand and offered this definition. It's like where the water indents into the land. Right, his teacher replied, trying to reinforce participation since so few hands had gone up. Then she added, well, except that a peninsula is where land indents into water, which is a little different. Her reward to the student for his effort was to provide him with misinformation. A peninsula, he heard, is pretty much where the water indents into the land, but different on some arcane point he need not really recall. Meanwhile, it's a safe bet that the students with whom he will compete for a seat in college are not learning to conflate bays and peninsulas. A better response might have been, a bay is what you call it when water indents into land, but a peninsula is a land formation. Who can tell me what a peninsula is? With the sequence ending with the kind of definition students get when their teachers believe they are going to college. A peninsula is a formation where land is surrounded on three sides by water. Write that down in your notes, please. A peninsula is a formation where land is surrounded on three sides by water. Though as teachers we are the defenders of right answers, of the standards of correctness, there are, in fact, four ways in which we are at risk of slipping in holding out for right, and thus four categories within the right is right technique. 1. Hold out for all the way. Great teachers praise students for their effort, but never confuse effort with mastery. A right answer includes the negative sign if a negative sign is warranted. There is no such thing as right, except you need a negative sign. When you ask for the definition of a noun and get a person, place, or thing, don't do students the disservice of overlooking the fact that the answer is incomplete. A noun is a person, place, thing, or idea. Simple, positive language to express your appreciation for what a student has done and your expectation that he or she will now march the last few yards is often the best way to address such a situation and retain positive tone in your classroom. Here are some phrases to do that. I like what you've done. Can you get us the rest of the way? We're almost there. Can you find the last piece? I like most of that. Can you develop that further? Okay, but there's a bit more to it than that. Kim just knocked a base hit. Who can bring her home? Another effective response is to repeat the student's words back to him or her, placing emphasis on incomplete parts if necessary. A peninsula is water, indenting into land. You just said that a noun is a person, place, or thing. You just said that a noun is a person, place, or thing, but freedom is a noun, and it's not exactly any of those three. You just said that first you would solve the exponent, and then you'd solve what's in parentheses. 2. Answer the question. Students learn quickly in school that when you don't know the right answer to a question, you can usually get by if you answer a different one, especially if you say something true and heartfelt about the wider world. Can't identify the setting in the story? Offer an observation about the theme of injustice in the novel instead. This reminds me of something from my neighborhood. Most teachers can't pass up a student's taking on issues of justice and fairness, even if what they asked about was the setting. Over time, students come to recognize this. If you're a right is right teacher, though, you know that the right answer to any question other than the one you asked is wrong, and you'll insist that the student answer the question you asked, not the one she wished you asked or what she confused it for. You might respond with something like, "We'll talk about that in a few minutes, Daniela. Right now I want to know about the setting." Another situation in which students answer a question other than the one you asked is when they conflate different types of information about a topic. For example, you ask for a definition. "Who can tell me what a compound word is?" And a student replies with an example. "Eyeball is a compound word." Or alternatively, you ask them to describe a concept. "When we refer to the area of a figure, what are we talking about? Who can tell me what area is?" And a student replies with a formula to solve for the concept. Length times width. In the thick of the action, it's easy to miss that these are right answers, but to the wrong question. And as you begin to listen for them, you'll find these kinds of exchanges far more common than you might expect. If you ask students for a definition and get an example, try saying, "Kim, that's an example. I want the definition." After all, knowing the difference between an example and a definition matters. 3. Right answer, right time. Students sometimes want to show you how smart they are by getting ahead of your questions, but it's risky to accept answers out of sequence. For example, when you are teaching students the series of steps needed to solve a problem, and a student you call on to provide step 3 gives the whole answer, you have a problem. Accepting her answer before you've shown all the steps required deprives the rest of your students of a full understanding of the process. It's tempting to think that it's a good thing that the class is moving ahead quickly, but it's not. It's one student. And besides, teaching a replicable, repeatable process is more important than teaching the answer to this problem. So it cheats the class if you respond favorably to one student's desire to move to the end. Instead, consider responding with something like, "My question wasn't about the solution to the problem, it was about what we do next. What do we do next?" Alternatively, if you are asking what motivates a character's actions at the beginning of a chapter, you might prepare to resist accepting or engaging an answer that discusses, even very insightfully, the more dramatic events that conclude the chapter, especially if the point of the discussion of the first part is to better understand the ending when you get there. If it was really possible to jump ahead to the end and still understand the topic of the lesson, you might ask yourself why you were teaching the first part anyway. The answer, of course, is probably that the first part is important. This argues for protecting the integrity of your lesson by not jumping ahead to engage an exciting right answer at the wrong time. 4. Use technical vocabulary. Good teachers get students to develop effective right answers using terms they are already comfortable with. Volume is the amount of space something takes up. Great teachers get them to use precise technical vocabulary. Volume is the cubic units of space an object occupies. This response expands student vocabularies and builds comfort with the terms the students will need when they compete in college. Technique 3. Stretch it. When students finally get an answer all the way right, there's a temptation, often justified, to respond by saying good or yes or by repeating the right answer, and that's that. Just as often, though, the learning can and should continue after a correct answer has been given. So it's great to remember to respond, as many of champion teachers do, to right answers by asking students to answer a different or tougher question, or by using the questioning to make sure that a right answer is repeatable, that is, the student knows how to get similar right answers again and again. The technique of rewarding right answers with more questions is called stretch it. This technique yields two primary benefits. First, by using stretch it to check for replicable understanding, you avoid falsely concluding that reliable mastery of material has been achieved without eliminating the possibility that luck, coincidence, or partial mastery led to a right answer to the question asked. Second, when students have indeed mastered parts of an idea, using stretch it lets you give them exciting ways to push ahead, applying their knowledge in new settings, thinking on their feet, and tackling harder questions. This keeps them engaged and sends the message that the reward for achievement is more knowledge. Incidentally, this also helps you solve one of the thorniest classroom challenges, differentiating instruction to students of different skill levels. We're sometimes socialized to think we have to break students up into different instructional groups to differentiate, giving them different activities and simultaneously forcing ourselves to manage an overwhelming amount of complexity. Students are rewarded with a degree of freedom that's as likely to yield discussions of last night's episode of American Idol as it is higher-order discussions of content. Asking frequent, targeted, rigorous questions of students as they demonstrate mastery is a powerful and much simpler tool for differentiating. By tailoring questions to individual students, you can meet students where they are and push them in a way that's directly responsive to what they've shown they can already do. There are several specific types of stretch it questions that are especially effective. Ask how or why. The best test of whether students can get answers right consistently is whether they can explain how they got the answer. Increasingly, state assessments ask these questions explicitly. One more reason for you to ask students to practice narrating their thinking process. Teacher: how far is it from Durango to Pueblo? Student: 600 miles. Teacher: how'd you get that? Student: by measuring 3 inches on the map and adding 200 plus 200 plus 200. Teacher: how do you know to use 200 miles for each inch? Student: I looked at the scale in the map key. Ask for another way to answer. Often there are multiple ways to answer a question. When a student solves it one way, it's a great opportunity to make sure they can use all available methods. Teacher: how far is it from Durango to Pueblo? Student: 600 miles. Teacher: how'd you get that? Student: by measuring 3 inches on the map and adding 200 plus 200 plus 200. Teacher: is there a simpler way than adding 3 times? Student: I could have multiplied 200 times 3. Teacher: and when you do that, you'd get what? Student: 600. Teacher: very nice. That's a better way. Ask for a better word. Students often begin framing concepts in the simplest possible language. Offering them opportunities to use more specific words, as well as new words with which they are gaining familiarity, reinforces the crucial literacy goal of developing vocabulary. Teacher: why did Sophie gasp, Janice? Student: she gasped because the water was cold when she jumped in. Teacher: can you answer with a word different from cold, one that shows how cold it was? Student: Sophie gasped because the water was freezing. Teacher: okay, how about using one of our vocabulary words? Student: Sophie gasped because the water was frigid. Teacher: very nice. Ask for evidence. As students mature, they are increasingly asked to build and defend their conclusions and support opinions from among multiple possible answers. This is especially the case in the humanities. Who's to say what the theme of the novel is or what the author intended to show in a given scene? By asking students to describe evidence that supports their conclusion, you stress the process of building and supporting sound arguments in the larger world, where right answers are not so clear. You also give yourself grounds to avoid reinforcing poor but subjective interpretations, a task that is often challenging for teachers. You don't have to say you don't agree, just ask for the proof. Teacher: how would you describe Dr. Jones's personality? What traits is he showing? Student: he's spiteful. Teacher: and spiteful means? Student: spiteful means that he's bitter and wants to make other people unhappy. Teacher: okay, so read me 2 sentences from the story that show us that Dr. Jones is spiteful. Ask students to integrate a related skill. In the real world, questions rarely isolate a skill precisely. To prepare students for that, try responding to mastery of one skill by asking students to integrate the skill with others recently mastered. Teacher: who can use the word stride in a sentence? Student: I stride down the street. Teacher: can you add some detail to show more about what stride means? Student: I stride down the street to buy some candy at the store. Teacher: can you add an adjective to modify street? Student: I stride down the wide street to buy some candy at the store. Teacher: good. Now, can you add a compound subject to your sentence? Student: My brother and I stride down the wide street to buy some candy at the store. Teacher. And can you put that in the past tense? Student. My brother and I strode down the wide street to buy some candy at the store. Teacher. Those were very challenging questions, Charles, and look how well you handled them. Ask students to apply the same skill in a new setting. Once students have mastered a skill, consider asking them to apply it in a new or more challenging setting. Teacher. So what's the setting of our story? Student. The setting is in a town called Sangerville in the recent past. Teacher. Good. I noticed that you remembered both parts of setting. Can you remember the setting of Fantastic Mr. Fox, then? Student. It was on a farm in the recent past. Teacher. How do you know it was the recent past? Student. They had tractors. Teacher. Good, but what about movies? Do movies have a setting? Student. Yes. Teacher. Great. I'll tell you a setting, and you see if you can tell me the movie. Stretch It asks students to be on their toes, to explain their thinking or apply knowledge in new ways. Just asking a quantity of tough questions isn't necessarily sufficient. In one fifth grade classroom, a student was asked by her teacher to use the vocabulary word passion in a sentence. I have a passion for cooking, she replied. Who else can use passion in a sentence? The teacher asked. I have a passion for basketball, answered a boy. The teacher accepted with a nod, where she might have stretched. Here was an opportunity to test whether the student really understood how to use the word or was just making a rote copy of a previous example. The teacher might have asked the student to use the adjective form of passion. Instead, she simply asked, anyone else? Four or five students methodically used the same sentence structure but replaced the object noun with some other. I have a passion for dancing. I have a passion for riding my bike. Making it an exercise in banal copying of a basal concept and ultimately low expectations. Think of all the ways the teacher could have used Stretch It with her students at an equal or lesser cost of time than the activity she chose. Can you rewrite your sentence to have the same meaning but start with the word cooking? What's the adjective form of passion? Can you rewrite your sentence using passion in its adjective form? If Marie had a passion for cooking, what sorts of things would you expect to find in her house? What would be the difference between saying, I was passionate about cooking, and saying, I was fanatical about cooking? What's the opposite of having a passion for something? Technique 4. Format matters. In school, the medium is the message. To succeed, students must take their knowledge and express it in a variety of clear and effective formats to fit the demands of the situation and of society. It's not just what students say that matters, but how they communicate it. The complete sentence is the battering ram that knocks down the door to college. The essays required to enter college, and every paper written once there, demand fluent syntax. Conversations with potential employers require subject-verb agreement. Use Format Matters to prepare your students to succeed by requiring complete sentences and proficient grammar every chance you get. Teachers who understand the importance of this technique rely on some basic format expectations. Grammatical format. Yes, you should correct slang, syntax, usage, and grammar in the classroom even if you believe the divergence from standard is acceptable, even normal in some settings, or even if it falls within a student's dialect. Or, more accurately, even if you perceive it to be normal within what you perceive to be a student's dialect. In fact, you may not know how a student's family or community speaks or what it views as normal or acceptable. And there is some history of young people adopting dialects or choosing to speak in a way different from the way their parents do or wish them to. To gloss the vast sociological discourse on what's standard, whether it's the only right form of language and even whether it is in fact correct, champion teachers accept a much more limited but practical premise. There is a language of opportunity, the code that signals preparedness and proficiency to the broadest possible audience. It's the code that shows facility with the forms of language in which work, scholarship, and business are conducted. In it, subjects and verbs agree, usage is traditional, and rules are studied and followed. If students choose to switch and use the language of opportunity selectively and only in school settings, so be it. But no matter what you tell your students about how they talk elsewhere, making the determination to prepare them to compete for jobs and seats in college by asking them to self-correct in class is one of the fastest ways to help them. There may be a time and place in which to engage them in a broader sociological discourse on dialect. Under what circumstances it can be acceptable to use dialect? Who determines correctness? How much subjectivity there is in that determination? What the broader implications of code switching are, and so on. Given the frequency of very real errors by students and the potential cost to them of allowing those errors to persist, find simple and minimally disruptive techniques to identify and correct errors with minimum distraction. That way you can correct consistently and seamlessly. Two simple methods are especially helpful. Identify the error. When a student makes a grammatical error, merely repeat the error in an interrogative tone. We was walking down the street? There gots to be eight of them? Then allow the student to self-correct. If the student fails to self-correct, use the next method or quickly provide the correct syntax and ask him or her to repeat. Begin the correction. When a student makes a grammatical error, begin to rephrase the answer as it would sound if grammatically correct, and then allow the student to complete it. In the examples above, that would mean saying, "We were," or "It has to," and leaving the student to provide the full correct answer. Complete sentence format. Strive to give students the maximum amount of practice building complete sentences on the spur of the moment. To do this, you can use one of several methods when students answer you in a fragment or a single word. You can provide the first words of a complete sentence to show students how to begin sentences. Teacher: James, how many tickets are there? James: 6. Teacher: There are... James: There are 6 tickets in the basket. Another method is to remind students before they start to answer, as in, Teacher: Who can tell me in a complete sentence what the setting of the story is? Student: The setting is the city of Los Angeles in the year 2013. And a third is to remind students afterward with a quick and simple prompt using the lowest possible disruption, as in, Teacher: What was the year of Caesar's birth? Student: 100 BC. Teacher: Complete sentence. Student: Julius Caesar was born in 100 BC. Some teachers substitute a code such as, like a scholar, to remind students to use complete sentences, as in, Who can tell me like a scholar? Audible format. There's not much point of discussing answers with 30 people if only a few can hear you. If it matters enough to say in class, then it matters that everyone can hear it. Otherwise, class discussion and student participation appear as afterthoughts, incidental banter. Underscore that students should be listening to their peers by insisting that their peers make themselves audible. Accepting an inaudible answer suggests that what a student said didn't matter that much. Perhaps the most effective way to reinforce this expectation is with a quick, crisp reminder that creates the minimum distraction from the business of class. Saying voice to students whose voice is inaudible, for example, is preferable to a 5-second disruption such as, Maria, we can't hear you in the back of the room. Would you speak up, please? In 3 ways. First, it is more efficient. In the language of business, it has a low transaction cost. It costs almost nothing in terms of a classroom's most precious commodity, time. In fact, a champion teacher can offer 3 or 4 reminders about voice in the time a less proficient teacher can remind one student in the style used with Maria previously. Transaction cost refers to the amount of resources it takes to execute an exchange, be it economic, verbal, or something else. Your goal is to make each necessary intervention with the least distraction from the task at hand and the least time away from what you were doing, and thus with the absolute minimum of words. Secondly, merely stating voice as opposed to offering a long-winded expectation suggests that you don't need an explanation for why you should speak up in class. The reason is self-evident, and the reminder makes it clear that speaking up is an expectation, not a favor. Third, by telling the student what to do as opposed to what she did wrong, the teacher avoids nagging, thus preserving her relationship with students and allowing her, if necessary, to remind often enough to make the expectation predictable and thus most effective in changing behavior. This last point deserves some amplification. Once several colleagues and I watched a teacher's lesson. Four or five times during that lesson, the teacher reminded students to speak audibly, but used the term louder as a reminder rather than the word voice. Her use of louder seemed to emphasize a lack of something. It constantly emphasized that expectations were not being met and thus narrated the negative, an idea you will read about in Positive Framing, Technique 43 in Chapter 7. Voice, by contrast, reinforces an expectation in a quick reminder that tells students what to try to achieve. My colleagues also noted that some teachers used the term voice with a finesse that was not achievable with the term louder. For example, Jayshon, can you use your voice to tell me how I'd find the least common multiple? Or, I need someone with voice to tell me what I need to do next. My colleagues and I concluded that voice is the gold standard when working on audible format. Unit format. In math and science class, replace naked numbers, those without units, with ones that are dressed. If you ask for the area of a rectangle and a student tells you it's 12, ask for the units or merely note that her numbers need some dressing up or look a bit underdressed. Technique 5. Without apology. Sometimes the way we talk about expectations inadvertently lowers them. If we're not on guard, we can unwittingly apologize for teaching worthy content and even for the students themselves. You won't do this when you use without apology. Apologies for content. When I returned to campus my junior year after studying abroad, I got last pick of the English electives and found myself in Professor Patricia O'Neill's class on British Romantic poets. I couldn't imagine anything less interesting and considered various forms of drastic action. Change majors, find a very powerful dean somewhere and plead pathetically in various ways. Alas, I was too busy with the other pursuits of a distracted college student to follow through. I thus backed into the single most interesting and engaging class I took in college. Professor O'Neill somehow convinced me that the well-being of the world urgently required me to stay up late reading William Wordsworth. She permanently changed the way I think and read. And imagine, if I'd been even vaguely organized, I'd never have taken her class. I suspect most readers have had a similar experience. Finding the thing that seemed least interesting became life-changing in the hands of a gifted teacher. The lesson? There is no such thing as boring content. In the hands of a great teacher who can find the way in, the material students need to master to succeed and grow is exciting, interesting, and inspiring, even if as teachers we sometimes doubt that we can make it so, and even if this doubt puts us at risk of undercutting it, watering it down, or apologizing for teaching it. There are four primary ways we are at risk of apologizing for what we teach. Assuming something will be boring. Saying something like, guys, I know this is kind of dull, let's just try to get through it. Or even, you may not find this all that interesting, is apologizing. Think for a minute about the presumption that your students will find something boring, even if it is genuinely uninteresting to you. Thousands of accountants love their job and find it fascinating, whether or not anyone else thinks they'd like the work. Someone has awakened them to its rarefied joys. Every year, thousands of students take pride and joy in diagramming sentences. A belief that content is boring is a self-fulfilling prophecy. There are teachers who make great and exciting and inspiring lessons out of every topic that some other teacher may consider a grind. Our job is to find a way to make what we teach engaging, and never to assume that students can't appreciate what's not instantly familiar to them, or what does not egregiously pander to them. Doing so suggests only a small faith in the power of education. Blaming it. A teacher who assigns the responsibility for the appearance of content in her class to some outside entity, the administration, state officials, or some abstract they, is blaming it. It sounds like this. This material is on the test, so we'll have to learn it. They say we have to read this, so... If it's on the test, it's also probably part of the curriculum, though the latter is a less emotionally charged way of thinking about it. And a better way to address it is to assume it's part of the curriculum for a reason, and start by reflecting on that rationale. Making it accessible. Making material accessible is acceptable, preferable even, when it means finding a way in, that is, finding a way to connect kids to rigorous college prep content. It's not so great when it dilutes the content or standards. It's okay to use a contemporary song to introduce the idea of the sonnet. It's not okay to replace sonnets with contemporary songs in your study of poetry. Here are some alternatives to apology. This material is great because it's really challenging. Lots of people don't understand this until they get to college, but you'll know it now. Cool. This can really help you succeed, for example, by helping you understand how sentences work. This gets more and more exciting as you come to understand it better. We're going to have some fun as we do it. A lot of people are afraid of this stuff, so after you've mastered it, you'll know more than most adults. There's a great story behind this. Content is one of the places the teaching is most vulnerable to assumptions and stereotypes. What does it say, for example, if we assume that students won't be inspired by books written by authors of other races, or by protagonists of different backgrounds than their own? More specifically, what does it say if we are more likely to assume those things about minority students? Do we think that great novels transcend boundaries only for some kids? Consider the novelist Ernest Gaines's description of the authors who inspired him to write. Gaines, who wrote several of the most highly acclaimed novels of the 20th century, including Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, A Lesson Before Dying, and A Gathering of Old Men, grew up poor in rural Louisiana on the same land his family had sharecropped for generations. He was the eldest of 12 children and was raised by his aunt, the kind of kid to whom some might ascribe a limited worldview, probably without asking, and to whom few would assign a diet of 19th-century Russian novelists. Yet Gaines recalls, "My early influences were the Russian writers such as Tolstoy, Turgenev, and Chekhov. I think I've also been influenced by Greek tragedy, but not by Ellison and any black writers. I knew very early what it was I wanted to write. I just had to find out a way to do it, and the writers whom I've mentioned showed me this way." Let me say that I love Ellison just as I love Gaines, and am not suggesting we not teach his work, to all students, incidentally. But imagine the loss, not just to Gaines, but to all of us, if the teacher who first put Turgenev in his hands and inspired the spark of genius to grow into a flame had looked at the color of his skin, assumed that Gaines wouldn't find interest in anything so foreign, and thought better of Turgenev. Apologies for students. Assuming something is too hard or technical for some students is a dangerous trap. At the first school I founded, the inner-city students we enrolled learned Mandarin Chinese as their foreign language. Not only did outsiders react with shock, "You're going to teach those kids Chinese?" But sometimes so did their parents. "She's not going to sit through that." But millions of people, most of them far poorer than our poorest student, learn Chinese every year. And in the end, every student did learn Chinese, much to their and their parents' enjoyment. There's a special pleasure in exploding expectations, and many of the black and Hispanic students in the school took special pleasure in using their Chinese exactly when people around them least expected it. This offers a reminder not to assume there's a they who won't really get something, say sonnets and other traditional forms of poetry, and that it's therefore better to teach them poetry through hip-hop lyrics instead. What happens when they take Introduction to Literature in their freshman year in college and have never read a poem written before 1900? Kids respond to challenges. They require pandering only if people pander to them. The skill of not apologizing for students is critical not only in the introduction and framing of material, but in reacting to responses to it. Sticking with kids, telling them you're sticking with them, and constantly delivering the message, "But I know you can," raises a student's self-perception. Here are some alternatives to apologizing. This is one of the things you're going to take real pride in knowing. When you're in college, you can show off how much you know about. Don't be rattled by this. There are a few fancy words, but once you know them, you'll have this down. "This is really tricky, but I haven't seen much you couldn't do if you put your minds to it. I know you can do this, so I'm going to stick with you on this question." It's okay to be confused the first time through this, but we're going to get it, so let's take another try. Reflection and practice. 1. The chapter presented 5 techniques for raising academic expectations in your classroom. No opt-out, right is right, stretch it, format matters, and without apology. Which of these will be the most intuitive for you to implement in your classroom? which will be the toughest and what will make it difficult. 2. There are a variety of reasons that a student might opt out of answering a question you asked. For example, a student is actively testing or defying you. A student is trying not to stand out in the classroom. A student genuinely does not know the answer. A student didn't hear you when you asked. A student didn't understand what you asked. See how many possible reasons for a no opt-out you can add to this list. How should the breadth of possible reasons listed cause you to consider or adapt the tone with which you engage students when you use no opt-out? 3. One of the keys to responding effectively to almost right answers, reinforcing effort but holding out for top quality answers, is having a list of phrases you think of in advance. After reflecting on which of the following phrases most match your style as a teacher, try to write 4 or 5 of your own. I like what you've done. Can you get us the rest of the way? We're almost there. Can you find the last piece? I like most of that. Can you develop that further? Okay, but there's a bit more to it than that. Satish just knocked a base hit. Who can bring him home? 4. Here's a list of questions you might hear asked in a classroom and the objective for the lesson in which they were asked. 6 + 5 = Objective. Students will be able to master simple computations, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. Who can use the word achieve in a sentence? Objective. Students will be able to increase their vocabulary through drills that explore the use of synonyms, antonyms, and different parts of speech. What do you think is the lesson of The Three Little Pigs? Objective. Students will be able to explore the moral of the story and the genre of fables in general. What is one branch of the U.S. government? Objective. Students will be able to understand the three branches of the U.S. government and how they relate to each other and current events. Try to think of 10 stretch-it questions you might ask for the one that's closest to what you teach. This is a great activity to do with other teachers. 5. Format matters. Next time you're observing a peer's class, guess how many times you will hear answers that are given in a single word or with a sentence fragment, in ungrammatical syntax, inaudibly. Then count how many times they actually occurred during your observation. Was the number more or less than you expected? Why? 6. Without apology. Try to imagine the most boring content, to you, that you could teach. Now, script the first 5 minutes of your class in which you find a way to make it exciting and engaging to students. Chapter 2. Planning that ensures academic achievement. The 5 planning techniques in this chapter are designed to be implemented before you walk in the door of your classroom. They are a bit different from the other techniques in this book in that they are not for the most part executed live in front of students. Few people will see you do them, but they set the stage for your success once you do walk in the door, so they are inextricably linked to the rest of the techniques you'll find in this book. To state the obvious, these 5 specific types of planning are critical to effective teaching. Technique 6. Begin with the end. When I started teaching, I would ask myself while I planned, what am I going to do tomorrow? The question revealed the flaws in my planning method in at least 2 critical ways, even without accounting for my sometimes dubious answers to the question. The first flaw was that I was thinking about an activity for my classes on the following day, not an objective, what I wanted my students to know or be able to do by the end of the lesson. It's far better to start the other way around and begin with the end. The objective. By framing an objective first, you substitute, what will my students understand today for what will my students do today? The first of these questions is measurable. The second is not. The only criterion that determines the success of an activity is not whether you do it and people seem to want to do it, but whether you achieved an objective that can be assessed. Instead of thinking about an activity, perhaps we are reading To Kill a Mockingbird, framing your objective forces you to ask what your students will get out of reading the book. Will they understand and describe the nature of courage as demonstrated in To Kill a Mockingbird? Will they understand and describe why injustice sometimes prevails as demonstrated in To Kill a Mockingbird? Or perhaps they'll use To Kill a Mockingbird to describe how important characters are developed through their words and actions. In short, there are lots of worthwhile things you can do in class and lots of ways you can approach each of them. Your first job is to choose the rationale that is most productive. Why are you teaching the material you're teaching? What's the outcome you desire? How does this outcome relate to what you'll teach tomorrow and to what your students need to have learned to be ready for the 4th or 8th or 10th grade? The second flaw in my question was that I was usually asking it the night before the class. Beyond the obvious procrastination that implies, it shows that I was planning my lessons singly, each lesson vaguely related to the previous, perhaps, but not reflecting an intentional progression in the purpose of my lessons. Of the two flaws, this was actually the more damning. I could cure the procrastination issue by planning all of my lessons the Friday before, say, but until I began to think of my lessons as parts of a larger unit that developed ideas intentionally and incrementally toward mastery of larger concepts, I was sure to be treading water. In fact, I would have been better off planning all of my objectives only for the trimester in advance, and then procrastinating the planning of each lesson, than I would have been dutifully planning a batch of activity-driven lessons the week before. Great lessons begin with planning, and specifically with effective unit planning. Planning a sequence of objectives, one or possibly two for each lesson, over an extended period of time, say 6 weeks. Unit planning means methodically asking how one day's lesson builds off the previous day's, prepares for the next day's, and how these three fit into a larger sequence of objectives that lead to mastery. Logically, then, it also implies that if you know you failed to achieve full mastery of one day's objective, an objective on which tomorrow's depends, you must go back and reteach the content to ensure full mastery before moving on. To be sure of mastery, great begin-with-the-end teachers often begin lessons by circling back to anything they're not sure the class mastered the day before. The unit planning process is followed by lesson planning, which consists of 1. Refining and perfecting the objective based on the degree to which the objective the day before was mastered. 2. Planning a short daily assessment that will effectively determine whether the objective was mastered. 3. Planning the activity, or more precisely, a sequence of activities that lead to mastery of the objective. Using this lesson planning sequence, objective, assessment, activity, disciplines your planning. It helps ensure that your criterion will not be, is my lesson creative, or does it employ enough of the right strategies, but will it be the best and fastest way to help me reach the goal? Don't underestimate how critical this is. The prevalence of flawed lesson criteria is a major issue in teaching. Teachers care about earning the respect and admiration of their peers, and when teachers praise each other for their lessons, they are as likely as not to praise an artful, clever design or the loyal use of recommended methods, such as group work, whether or not they yield results. Having effective lesson criteria, did this lesson accomplish the goal, allows you to constantly evaluate and refine your strategy and technique rather than flying blind. To some, begin with the end means 1. Progressing from unit planning to lesson planning, 2. Using a well-framed objective to define the goal of each lesson, 3. Determining how you'll assess your effectiveness in reaching your goal, 4. Deciding on your activity. Technique 7. 4 M's. Given the importance of objectives in bringing focus, discipline, and measurability to a lesson, it's important to think about what makes an objective useful and effective. My colleague Todd McKee artfully designed 4 criteria for effective objectives, the 4 M's, and if you're able to ensure that your objectives meet those criteria, your chances of starting with an effective goal are high. Effective objectives should be manageable. An effective objective should be of a size and scope that can be taught in a single lesson. It's not that you don't want your students to master the broad, rich, deep, and critically important skill of making character inferences, for example. But setting the goal that students will learn to make strong character inferences in a single hour's practice is patently unrealistic. Actually, it requires weeks to establish a firm basic mastery. You'd want to revisit it constantly thereafter to build depth and context into your students' skill and to give them lots of practice. One of the most common misconceptions about objectives is that they preclude you from talking about other things during class. Of course, you should take time to discuss how you'd make effective inferences to better understand the nature of a character in a story during your lessons working toward mastery of theme, plot, use of evidence, and so forth. In fact, doing so and knowing that your students can do so should reinforce your effectiveness in achieving those goals. Given the importance of character inference, a key part of the process necessary to do it justice is to conceptualize in your own mind the steps necessary to achieve mastery. You will have to do different things each day so that your students will master the skill. Perhaps you'll start by identifying words and actions that provide evidence of character, then practice interpreting them singularly, then practice assembling evidence and examining multiple pieces of it at once. Or perhaps you'll want to start with inferences about simple stock characters and work your way up to more complex, nuanced ones. Either way, it would be a mistake to use the same broad objective every day for 3 weeks while you work on the skill. You would have a much greater chance of success if you built a series of day-by-day objectives that set achievable goals for each day. Not only would you make your work more strategic, but you'd also gain a better and better sense for what your students could accomplish in a day. Knowing how fast they can master information means knowing whether you need 2 or 3 weeks to master the basic skill. Measurable. An effective objective should be written so that your success in achieving it can be measured, ideally by the end of the class period. This lets you better understand in your own mind what worked in your implementation. The best teachers take this opportunity to the next logical step. They measure every lesson with an exit ticket, a short activity question or set of questions that students must complete and leave with you before departing. See Technique 20 in Chapter 3. Even if you don't use exit tickets, setting an explicit measurable goal beforehand helps you hold yourself accountable. Finally, setting measurable lesson objectives disciplines you in other ways. For example, it forces you to think through key assumptions. If your goal is to have students know something or understand something or think something, how will you know they have reached it? Thoughts are not measurable unless they are described or applied. Does your lesson include that? Do your lessons rely on a balance of methods for describing or applying understanding? Furthermore, if your goal is to have students feel, think, or believe something, how appropriate is that? Is it sufficient to be able to read and understand poetry without enjoying, appreciating, or loving it? Are students accountable for learning skills that can help them make up their own minds, or for accepting the judgments and tastes of others? I am a pretty fair case study of this. Although I have a master's degree in English literature, I do not enjoy reading poetry. In fact, I usually find it almost unreadable. I'm sorry to say, to all my fantastic professors and teachers, that I have almost never achieved the objective of loving a poem. Nevertheless, having learned to analyze and sustain arguments about poetry, and having had to critique those of others, has helped me to become a more effective thinker and writer, and occasionally, very occasionally, my wife might argue, a more insightful person. So in the end, I am truly glad to have studied and read poems in my literature classes. My point is that my best teachers held themselves accountable for what they could control, the quality of my thinking and sustainability of my arguments, not what they couldn't, whether I liked reading the stuff. Even though their love for the things they taught me was probably their reason for doing the work, passing that love on to me fell into the realm of what they couldn't control. And so they eschewed it as their objective, even if it was their motivation. An irony, to be sure, but a useful one. Made first. An effective objective should be designed to guide the activity, not to justify how a chosen activity meets one of several viable purposes. The objective comes first. The rationale for this is described in Begin with the End. Be aware, however, of just how many teachers who believe they are objective-driven start with an activity. We're playing Jeopardy today. We're reading I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings Today. And retrofit an objective to it. You can often tell these teachers because their objectives look like learning standards, which are different and far broader, and are occasionally written on the board, undigested from state documents. 3L6. Students will read a variety of texts for understanding. To risk beating a dead horse, you must digest the standard into a strategic series of daily objectives to ultimately achieve its broader mastery by mastering a series of component pieces. Most important. An effective objective should focus on what's most important on the path to college and nothing else. It describes the next step straight up the mountain. The following objectives fail to meet at least one of the 4M criteria. Students will be able to add and subtract fractions with like and unlike denominators. This objective isn't manageable. It contains at least 4 different objectives for 4 different days, and more likely 4 different weeks. Adding fractions with like denominators, subtracting fractions with like denominators, adding fractions with unlike denominators, and subtracting fractions with unlike denominators. Realistically, this objective is a standard, a huge one, and the topic of a unit plan. Students will be able to appreciate various forms of poetry, including sonnets and lyric poetry. What is appreciation? How will you know whether it happened? Can students understand T.S. Eliot and not like his writing, or do they have to pretend to assimilate your tastes as well? This objective isn't measurable. It's probably not manageable either. Students will view scenes from the film version of The Crucible. This objective is an activity, not an objective. Therefore, it's not made first. Showing the film version of Arthur Miller's play The Crucible could be a home run or a waste of time, depending on what its purpose is. Will students compare the film version of The Crucible to Elizabeth George Spears' The Witch of Blackbird Pond? If so, why? To learn what? Will they compare the portrayal of colonial witchcraft in the two stories? If so, with what purpose? For example, will students better understand Spears' perspective on witchcraft by comparing it to another contemporary story? If so, that should be described in the objective. To better understand the author's perspective on witchcraft in colonial America by comparing her portrayal to another contemporary portrayal. Students will construct a poster to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This objective isn't most important. Skill at making posters won't help put students in a position to succeed through the content of their character. Understanding Dr. King's legacy certainly is deeply important, and that understanding might even be reflected in a poster. But a champion teacher would consider poster making useful only if it was the best way to reinforce that understanding. The objective should be about Dr. King. Technique 8. Post it. Once your objective is complete, post it in a visible location in your room, the same location every day. So everyone who walks into the room, your students as well as peers and administrators, can identify your purpose for teaching that day in as plain English as possible. In the case of students, posting your objective is important because they should know what they're trying to do. Awareness of this fact will help them work more intentionally toward the goal. In the example of the crucible, students will watch better if they know what they're looking for. You can go a step further by making the objective part of the fabric of the classroom conversation. You can underscore its importance by asking students to discuss, review, copy, or read it as a matter of habit at the outset or at the conclusion of the lesson. You might even make a habit of asking your students to be able to put the objective in context, to say why it matters, to connect it to what happened yesterday, and so on. In the case of visitors, for example, your fellow teachers or your supervisor, it's important because visitors give you feedback, and feedback is more useful when the person giving it knows what you're trying to do. If they address not just whether your teaching was good in some abstract sense, but whether it appeared to be getting you to your goal. A visitor who thinks you should be discussing more about how the characters are developed in The Crucible may or may not be right. Whether you should spend more time on the development of characters depends on what your purpose is, and it's to your benefit to discipline those who help you to focus on what best accomplishes the task as well. Otherwise, their advice and evaluation of your lesson fall to idiosyncratic criteria. Your department chair observes you and says you should be emphasizing character development more, because in the end, that's what she does with The Crucible. Technique 9. Shortest path. When you can think of more than one possible activity to achieve an objective, your rule of thumb should be something like Occam's razor. All other things being equal, the simplest explanation or strategy is the best. Opt for the most direct route from point to point. the shortest path to the goal. Eschew the complex if something less clever, less cutting-edge, less artfully constructed will yield a better result. Use what the data tell you works best, but when in doubt, rely on proven, direct, trustworthy methods, especially I, we, you, see Chapter 3. This seems obvious, but in a profession where teachers for years had become accustomed to flying blind, that is, not having objective criteria with which to measure the effectiveness of their lessons, a culture of non-mastery-based criteria emerged. How clever, how artfully designed, how enjoyable to teach, how inclusive of various state-of-the-art philosophies is the lesson? If you listen carefully, you will hear constant implicit and explicit reference to such criteria in the discussions of teachers. I loved your lesson. The stations were so well designed, and there was so much peer interaction. The assumption in such a statement is that both of those things are inherently positive in their own right. Whether they best achieve the goal and whether they make achieving the goal take twice or half as long. Again, the criterion is mastery of the objective and what gets you there best and fastest. Group work, multisensory approaches, open inquiry, Socratic seminars, discussions and lectures are neither good nor bad for a teacher to use except in how they relate to this goal. Take the shortest path and throw out all other criteria. Shortest path does not necessarily mean that the shortest path you choose is an approach sustained for 45 minutes or an hour and 20 minutes. Champion teachers are generally inclined to make their lessons motivating by switching among a series of reliable activities with a variety of tones and paces, a method discussed more fully in the section on pacing in Chapter 8. These can be energetic and spirited or reflective and deliberate, often within the same lesson. The terrain always changes, even on the shortest path between two points. Technique 10. Double plan. At its best, lesson planning is driven by an objective that's part of a carefully planned sequence of objectives. It determines how to assess the outcome before choosing activities to get from A to B. Good lesson planning also requires specificity. Great teachers often plan their questions, and like Julie Jackson at North Star Academy, they memorize them on their drive to school or their walk to class. But there's a final element to effective lesson planning that's often overlooked and especially powerful. Double plan. Most lesson plans focus on what you, the teacher, will be doing, what you'll say and explain and model, what you'll hand out and collect and assign. Too often, teachers forget to plan what students will be doing each step of the way. What will they be doing while you're reviewing the primary causes of the Civil War? Will they be taking notes? If so, where? On a blank sheet of paper? On a graphic organizer you've designed? Will they then review those notes and write a quick one-sentence summary? While you explain the difference between prime and composite numbers, what will their task be? To listen carefully? To fill in a T-chart? To try to remember three key differences? To watch and listen, but respond to occasional whole class call and response questions? For example, prime numbers are not what class? Thinking about and planning for what students will do is critical. It helps you see the lesson through their eyes and keeps them productively engaged. It helps remind you that it's important to change pace occasionally during your lesson, and for students to change pace, to get to do a variety of things during a lesson. Write, reflect, discuss. One way to start yourself thinking this way is to make a double plan. Plan your lessons using a T-chart with you on one side and them on the other. I don't know many teachers